Thank you to everybody who has sent in their messages and told me their stories and asked their questions. Well, I appreciate it very much. If I haven't got back to you immediately, or if it takes some time to reply, please know that it's basically just because of my own bad record keeping. It's not because of you. I have messages coming in from 3 or 4 different email accounts, Facebook, Facebook Messenger, Instagram, text, phone message, and the like. So if some of those messages, I don't always organize them very well. So it's my own cack-handedness that's the result of a bad response time. It's nothing to do with you or your message. Please know that. There have been one set of questions coming through, which all vaguely fall under the similar heading. So I want to deal with that in this session. And essentially, they are questions to do with participation in movements or large movements. Here, specifically talking about Black Lives Matter or some of the protests that are happening in the countries that I'm most familiar with. So in Canada, in the United Kingdom, and in the United States, but I know also in other countries across the world, there are lots of protests and movements and organized groups who are speaking up. And now I have lots of emails from well-intentioned, well-meaning Christians who are wondering about their participation in some of these groups, to the extent that they should be doing it, or concerns about allying oneself to organized groups which have aims and agendas that a follower of Christ might have difficulty with. A very classic example here is Black Lives Matter, because of course Black Lives Matter. There's no ifs or buts about that. And some of the organized groups marching under that banner or using that name also have as their explicit aim Marxist tendencies or anarchist tendencies. And so there's a question here coming up from people of like, well, we do support Black Lives Matter, but we don't support Marxism, or we don't support violent overthrow of the powers that be. So how much can we ally with these groups, or how much should we be identifying with these names, which mean more than one thing at the same time? And obviously these are good questions, and they're obviously very relevant to today. And on a related note, I'm also getting emails from people who are being told by their evangelical friends that Jesus' kingdom is not of this world, therefore we shouldn't be too involved in the movements of this world, and we shouldn't let their agenda dominate us. And also things like, well, following Jesus is a matter of the heart or the individual or the private life, and one's public role is different than one's private role. And these are the sorts of questions that are coming. One listener, she sent me a little transcription of the conversation she'd been having online with one of her white American evangelical friends. And in lots of ways, it was a typical conversation that we all probably are going to be having or have already around dinner tables or on social media. And it's interesting because this American evangelical friend, she was not spewing hate and bile. She clearly is or wants to be anti-racist. She clearly wants to follow Jesus. So this isn't somebody who's representing the Ku Klux Klan here, okay? And in some ways, it makes these conversations harder because it's so hard to tell the difference between what sounds good and what actually is good. Now, this conversation that I'm talking about was centered around a YouTube video, or perhaps it was a Facebook video, that was uploaded by a man named Jerry Roberts. And Jerry Roberts is a black man. He's a farmer in Texas, or a rancher, and he does these videos. And the one I looked at was he was talking about the Bible, and he's very lovely, engaging man, very kind-hearted, you can just tell. And he's fixing a fence, the one I'm talking about. I wish I had an actual link to send you, but I can't do that. But he's fixing a fence, a barbed wire fence, and then sort of pauses in order to talk. And he talks for about 6 minutes. This is a video that's been doing the rounds, and people have been liking it and loving it. And the gist of it is that he's overfilling with the Bible. He clearly knows the Bible and loves the Bible. He clearly loves Jesus. And he's talking about how you shouldn't let other narratives dominate your identity. And he says, you know, he doesn't want the Black Lives Matter movement to overtake people's identity, and that your citizenship is in heaven, and that, you know, that kind of thing. And that we shouldn't allow anger and despair to dominate us. or allow any one particular group that identifies primarily with a racial identity to be the basis for our own identity. And as I say, this has been a very popular video, and if you read the comments underneath, it's filled with people, many of whom you can tell from their profiles are white people, who love this stuff. They're absolutely loving it, all right? It's really speaking to something that they want to hear. Now, my issue is not with Jerry Roberts. In fact, I think I could sit down with Jerry Roberts. I was watching his video, and I was like, I could sit down with Jerry Roberts, and I could talk about benign indifference till the day is done. And I think he and I would agree. A lot of what he's talking about is essentially just the same kinds of things I've been trying to say, which is that the identity of the follower of Christ does treat one's home nationality and home race and home allegiances with a type of benign indifference that Jerry Roberts is showing in his video. My concern is not what Jerry Roberts is saying, by and large. There's a couple of minor problems that I'm going to talk about here. But by and large, my concern is not what the black man is saying. It's what his white listeners are hearing. And it's connected to the earlier thing I mentioned, which was the complaints that you get from conservative white evangelicals, particularly about Black Lives Matter, how it's a socialist agenda, or there's some sort of radical anarchy, or they're trying to bring down the patriarchy, or they're trying to bring down the nuclear family or paternalism. And these are all stated aims of various Black Lives Matter movements. And so because of this ideological impurity, white Christians are finding themselves freely able to discount Black Lives Matter in the same way that white Christians are so happy to hear a black man offer a biblical critique of Black Lives Matter. This is what's the important thing here. Itching ears are hearing what they want to hear. Let's talk very specifically about this idea of ideological compromise or impurity, which you find all the time. I've seen it. There was a long post that was sent to me, Facebook post sent to me, by a prominent Bethelite, talking about how Howard Zinn, who's a radical historian who writes a book called The People's History of America, how Howard Zinn is behind the Black Lives Matter movement and how this is a radical socialist agenda and all this kind of stuff. And the gist of the post was that Black Lives Matter is fundamentally anti-American, therefore it should be discounted, because it's seen to stand against some of the principles and structures that have made America great, then we should discount it. And it would just note, once again, that it's not the Bible or appeals to Jesus or the way of Jesus that is marking whether these movements should rise or fall. It's purely based on whether it offends American patriotism of the white evangelical. So once again, you see that the logic of patriotism trumps everything else, and that is the measure of goodness for so many self-confessed Christians and charismatics and evangelicals in this world. But more specifically, let's look at this idea of ideological compromise. The idea that you are given license to avoid a movement or warn people against joining a movement because you have identified in its foundations or amongst some of its spokespeople ideological positions that you don't like or that you think are suspect to Christianity. Okay. First of all, note that it's the same people who are so worried about ideological compromise with atheists, and they're using that as their excuse not to have anything to do with Black Lives Matter. These are the same people who are openly supportive of the libertarian movement or the wing in the Republican Party, the Tea Party movement, the economic ideology of Milton Friedman, and the free market, low regulation economics that conservatives especially love. Well, this all has in its roots Ayn Rand. After the Bible, it's Ayn Rand's books that are the most popular books in the American bookshops. And Ayn Rand was an open, enthusiastic, and ardent atheist who mocked Jesus. You can find videos of her on American talk shows mocking Jesus and followers of Jesus, who said, if anyone tells you that the love of money is the root of all evil, you should run a million miles in the opposite direction. The evangelical and charismatic world in America is absolutely filled with Ayn Randians who read The Fountainhead or Atlas Shrugged or other books of her philosophies. And they seem to have no problem at all taking what they like about her baptized selfishness and greed is good philosophy and turning it into some sort of Christian individualism. No problem at all. And likewise, these same people who are using their public platforms to encourage their followers not to support Black Lives Matter because they don't like that there are some Black Lives Matter protesters who are atheists or Marxists or whatever, well, these are the same people that will dismiss you out of hand when you point out to them that Trump supporters include self-confessed members of the Ku Klux Klan, self-confessed Nazi supporters, that there are swastikas flying at Trump rallies, and that the whole apparatus of the Make America Great Again campaign and the Trump movement has on its payroll white supremacists and nationalists and has had those ideological friends from the start. And if you don't know who Steve Bannon is or Stephen Miller, or if you haven't been paying attention to the well-known and well-documented ties that the Trump movement has with white supremacy and white nationalism, as well as nationalist movements and racist movements across the world and the allies he's forming in Europe, well then, you aren't paying attention. But more than that, you don't care. And it's the not caring that is important here. It's the ability that I've seen, and I'm seeing all the time, for itching ears to hear only what they want to hear. And all humans do it all the time. But right now, I'm looking at the log in our own eye. White Christians. Notice how inevitably, if ever there's a black voice that speaks up against Black Lives Matter, that will be the one that the evangelical white Christians like the most. Somebody like a Candace Owens, for example, or perhaps this farmer fence post preacher that I talked about. These will be the ones that get spread like wildfire on social media. And it's exactly analogous to the way that these self-same nationalist evangelical groups will elevate and amplify the voice of the 1% of social or environmental scientists who are questioning climate change at the expense of the 99%, the overwhelming majority of scientists and social experts who are telling us that there's a problem. And the reason why these groups, the reason why we white Christians do not like to hear any voice that is challenging us is because we have a vested interest in maintaining the status quo and comfortable nature of our inherited set of traditions, prejudices, and privileges. In short, we're part of a principality. Remember, principalities and powers mean faceless forces which influence our lives. All humans everywhere create principalities. Whenever people get together and agree about anything, consciously or unconsciously, they've created a faceless force which is now going to influence their lives. And the story of how those faceless forces go corrupt is always the story of when they act like they are the ones in which you live and move and have your being. When they start to act like they didn't have a beginning and they don't have a purpose. When they act like little gods. The principality becomes malignant or becomes demonic. When it bursts its bounds. When it allows no one to put it back in its place. And you can always tell when a principality has become an idol is when it resists being put back in its place. So it's so easy for me to see white evangelicals resisting any voice that is going to make them feel uncomfortable or that's going to lead to them having to actually dismantle some forms of life or think again about some of the things they've inherited and the structures that they live in and move and have their being. And this is what you see all the time. And sometimes the resistance happens through outright violence, and let's pay attention to how much outright violence does happen on a daily basis to preserve the status quo that white evangelicals have grown accustomed to. But let's also pay attention to how the principalities resist being challenged through things like the itching ears hearing only what they want to hear, through amplifying only those voices which already defend what we think we already know about ourselves and what we want to believe about ourselves. Principalities tend to own the space or dominate the space that they're in. They set the parameters so that they define reality. So anything that comes from the outside is seen to be unreal or abnormal. So part of the idolatry of a principality is when it defines normality, when it says, this is the way things are and the way they're supposed to be. So anything that challenges this is a challenge to reality. The truth is, no one human narrative or agreed collective forms of life does set the parameters for reality. There's more than one way of thinking about the world. There's more than one way of organizing your power or sharing your imagination or collective agreements with each other. And so reality is much bigger than any one inherited form of life. Remember, when we use the word political, we don't just mean partisan politics or party politics. In fact, that sort of noisy tribalism of voting for your favorite team every 4 or 5 years, that's just a very tiny part of what it is to be political. A tiny part which has unfortunately dominated our imaginations. But when we speak about politics or being political, we also mean any time that humans share their power according to an agreed upon collective imagination. So it's the gathering and the use of power for a particular vision or purpose. And this happens in families, this happens in churches, this happens in universities or schools or businesses. Any place where you find humans getting together to agree about something, they are also agreeing how they're going to use their individual power for a common purpose. And the issue with all this is that we're negotiating space with other people who also have a different vision of power and what they think they're going to do with their collective power and whether they think they should give it away or who they should give it away to or how they're going to get more of it. So reality isn't defined by one collective vision of power. It's defined by multiple stories, multiple groups, multiple principalities negotiating space with each other. That's the reality that we live in. So when you find one principality or one form of life which is dominating the space, either explicitly or implicitly, that's where you find idolatry, or that's where you find a principality bursting its bounds, taking more than it's owed. And amongst some Christian nationalist groups like the Dominionists and the Seven Mountains type ideology, sometimes the taking over this public space is explicit. It's very much a part of their vision. But other times this is unconscious. It's just assumed, blindly assumed, that of course white American evangelicalism, for example, defines the space. It's neutral, it's normal, and every other voice is somehow unnatural. It's a challenge. And so the job then becomes seen as the member of the in-group to preserve the status quo against all outsiders and to filter and discern the voices very carefully to make sure that nothing upsets the normal way of life too much. Of course, the discernment doesn't ever seem to apply to the inner group. Nobody seems to worry that much about the bad voices or the corrupt voices that have gone into forming the status quo. It's always looking at the corrupt or bad voices coming from outside. And this isn't to say that other groups, of course, Black Lives Matter is a principality. And of course, it also, as a movement, as a series of humans who have shared their power for a collective vision, of course, Black Lives Matter or any human group and movement is going to need to have eyes on it and in an internal reckoning process and an ability to make sure that the principality doesn't burst its bounds and take more than it should or define reality more than it should, of course. But what we're concerned with here is the followers of Jesus. How do we approach this kind of stuff? And one of the things to do is to be very aware that we are all part of a principality. It is non-optional. And in fact, we're part of more than one, multiple principalities. Often they're in conflict with each other. Often we're part of different principalities which have different visions for how power should be used. But in any case, this is the world that we live in. So the Christian or the follower of Jesus, our imagination is aimed at finding ways to identify when the principalities that we are a part of are claiming too much or bursting their bounds, when they've grown inhuman, and then to be able to witness to these powers, to put them back in their place, to put them in their right order, to remind them what their purpose is. And part of this process means not clutching tightly to the principalities that we are born into, not clutching tightly to the rights and expectations of our home group, of the group that's telling us what's important or what we deserve or what we need to protect and defend. To hold these things with an open hand is to be Christ-like. The charismatics quite rightly use a phrase called the orphan spirit to describe people who are clutching tightly, hunkered down, fearful and worried about their meager resources, not wanting to give anything away because they are fearful that there'll be no replacement. And to these kinds of people is what Jesus was saying to his disciples when he said, "Do not fear, I am not leaving you like orphans, but it's good that I'm going away because then I'm going to give my Holy Spirit." And the Holy Spirit keeps on giving. You can give away because there's always more. You can do the things that the follower of Jesus is being asked to do because it's not your own power, it's not your own meager resources. The kingdom of God has a lot more resources going for it than the kingdoms of man. All principalities which have grown malignant and all patriotic narratives rely on this idea that there are limited resources, not enough to go around, so we need to band together with people who look like us and sound like us as much as possible. This is the kind of orphan spirit which underlies all the kind of woke fundamentalism where you see the left wing side of the culture tearing itself apart over not saying exactly the right words at the right times. But it's also the same logic you see tearing apart Facebook, tearing apart your churches, tearing apart conservatives as well. Everybody's competing essentially over what they think are limited resources, including power. We can't possibly let other people say anything or have a different opinion because it's a fundamental challenge to our own ability to define reality. And I see this as an orphan spirit which infuses all principalities across the whole political spectrum. But I'm not concerned about lobbing stones at other people right now. I'm concerned about the fact that white evangelical Christians, my tribe, are so resistant to having their power challenged or their narrative challenged or their comfortable way of life challenged because they are clutching tightly to their resources and their power in order to preserve the principality they were born into, which has now dominated and controlled their lives to such an extent that it is clearly a more important God than Jesus. I mentioned at the beginning of this episode the idea that Jesus' kingdom is not of this world, or that following Jesus is a private act and not a public act, and therefore Christians should stay away from quote-unquote politics or big mass movements and mass protests. This is an idea very deeply ingrained in the principality that is Protestant evangelicalism. And we don't have time to go into the deep history of it all, but it's individualism. It's the idea that everything begins and ends with the individual, and that the message of Jesus and the message of the gospel is primarily about your individual salvation. This is also melded very easily with the American dream, the idea of pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, the idea that you get out what you put in, the Protestant work ethic, the idea that poverty is a moral failing and it's only because you didn't try hard enough or work hard enough. These are very deeply ingrained ideas which evangelicals across the world have absorbed. And as I say, there's a whole history for it. There's a whole intellectual archaeology that can be done, and reams of paper have been written on this. I'm not inventing this idea at all. One thing that we need to look at here, though, is how the idea of individualism has colonized the Christian imagination. and how this idea that the individual, the private life, is the most important part of your life, is the only real part of your life, how that idea is being used to filter out how people read the scriptures, for example, or how they see the life of Jesus. Individualism is not something that is derived from the New Testament. It's something that is read into the New Testament. It's an interpretive lens which is being used. And it has in its roots, not at all incidentally, a nationalism and a patriotism involved with the Protestant Reformation and the rise of the idea of sovereignty. How individual states within the European empires were carving out for themselves a national sovereignty. The very first ever Protestants weren't called Protestants because they were protesting against the Roman Catholic theology. It was applied to the German princes who were protesting against overarching authority of the emperor. And they had latched on to Martin Luther's theological ideas and saw in them a very useful vehicle for carving out sovereignty. And there's lots of leading to this. You get the French Revolution, you get the American Revolution, and the Wars of Independence. What's happening here is convulsions in the world which are trying to break out of domination systems and in the name of individual and small unit freedoms. And of course, as a corrective to a monstrous or demonic principality, individual freedoms are an excellent thing. But now let's notice how individual freedoms and the mantra of individualism has itself become the dominant principality and is itself now defining reality in which people swim and move and have their being. And they have forgotten or not noticed that individuality itself has a place and a purpose. And it's grown too big. And one of the places I see it growing too big or taking more than it's owed is in the reading of the Gospels and the logic of the follower of the way of Jesus. And you can see this happening all the time. In any time you see somebody who says, ah, yes, but Jesus' kingdom is not of this world, so therefore we should have nothing to do with shared collective vision for society. We should have nothing to do with power and politics. For one thing, Jesus said that when he was standing in front of Pilate in the Gospel of John. And the Gospels, all of them, want you to know, they spend a lot of energy telling you that the groups that killed Jesus were shared collective visions of power. It was a popular group, the popular mob, bade for Jesus' blood. The Jewish priests and Pharisee group, which represent the religious ethnic purity, they bade for Jesus' blood. And it was the Romans, the ones who represent overweening power and organized violence and domination, they're the ones who actually killed Jesus. These are the three main groups that are represented as the ones that put Jesus on the cross. It wasn't your individual sin that put Jesus there. It was our sin that put him there. The collective, organized, agreed upon sin is what put Jesus on the cross. And the Gospels don't hide that. And then, as I pointed out in a previous session, in Colossians 2, it's these collective, agreed upon, habitual and common sense sins that Jesus exposes to open shame on the cross. But returning to Pilate and the Gospel of John, Jesus is standing before Pilate and he says to him, don't you know, my kingdom is not of this world. And he doesn't mean my kingdom has come from some alien place and has nothing to do with the people of this world. What he means is, my kingdom is not of this world, of soldiers and law courts and baying mobs outside and climbing the slippery pole to success and making sure that you keep your superiors happy and your inferiors fearful. My kingdom is not of this world. It's of a different world. But the different world that Jesus talks about his kingdom being is not an alien world. It's a recreation of reality in the here and now. The kingdom of God is now, he says. The kingdom of heaven is now. When the New Testament talks about the language of heaven, it's not talking about a place you go to when you die. This is part of the individualistic and sentimental principality that evangelicals and Protestants, well, Christians in the modern era, have absorbed. But in the New Testament imagination, The word heaven refers not to some place you go to so much as it refers to the state of existence in which God's reign is unopposed. And the earliest Christian hope was not that they escape the earth and go to heaven. It's that your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as in heaven. Or it's that, like the book of Revelation has, where heaven and earth are remade and there's a new city which is glowing with the light of heaven, and the humans no longer have to ask each other what is right and wrong because they're all guided by the light of God. God's reign is unopposed. Another way of saying God's reign is unopposed is to say where people say yes to God. And Jesus more than once says he's speaking with the Father's voice. And when we hear him speak, he's speaking as the Father. And then he says, the kingdom of heaven is now. You can say yes to God now. And this is what's happening in the New Testament. It's a function of ruling and reigning, not a function of dying and your spirit going somewhere. Salvation was a salvation from the rule of men now, and the institution of the rule of God now. Which is why the word gospel, euangelion, meant the rightful king has broken the siege. This was the sort of message that the earliest Christians had. And I've said it many times, you go read the book of Acts. The earliest followers of Jesus didn't think they were starting a religion. They thought they were starting a new kingdom. And the kingdoms had forms of life and rules and habits and identity structures that other kingdoms have. It's just that the Christians did it differently. They didn't see the membership of their kingdom defined by ethnic or linguistic markers. They didn't see it defined as habitual forms of life you were born into and needed to fiercely protect from other groups. For the earliest Christians, there was no such thing as a private or anonymous Christian. You didn't follow Jesus secretly in your inner heart. You were seen to be with him or seen to be with his movement. That's what faith meant. That's what it meant to be a follower of Jesus. It was seen to be with. And again, you'll see this constantly in the book of Acts or in Paul's letters, where there's no institution of a private morality, which at the moment that it impinges upon a public responsibility, you're supposed to show your allegiance to the public world, which is exactly the response seen today by Christians who are previously or have a prior commitment to patriotism. And then they say, you cannot follow the Sermon on the Mount and run a country. Therefore, we won't follow the Sermon on the Mount. Or we will make the Sermon on the Mount be something about the private response, but in the public realm, you have to adopt a different code of morality. But this is an absolute nonsense. For one thing, Jesus wasn't speaking about private acts. He's speaking about public law courts. He's talking about being publicly shamed when you're hit on one cheek. He's talking about when a Roman occupying soldier forces you to carry his pack, you should willingly go an extra mile. These are all teachings aimed at people who are living in a threat of immediate violence. And he's telling them or asking them to act in ways that all the world around them would see and know to be public acts of a different sort of kingdom. The context of all of the Sermon on the Mount is very much an outer display that comes from an inner certainty that there is always more. You don't have to clutch tightly to what is rightfully yours. Even though all the organized violent Jews and all the organized violent Gentiles around you are saying something different, this is how we're supposed to act, says Jesus. Following Jesus is deeply personal, but it's never private. In fact, there is actually philosophically no such thing as a private act. As soon as you act, it's public. There is no such thing as private versus public. There is only intentions and acts. And as soon as you act, your work is out there and it will be interacted with by other people. And it will develop and help to set patterns of forms of life. And this is what the earliest followers of Jesus are doing. They're setting patterns and habits and forms of life according to the logic of heaven, of the reign of God that is unopposed. And they're opposing to that the reigns of men, the temporary rule of men. And this is the thing that Jesus is asking his people to unwean themselves from, the bad habits that they're learning from the principalities and powers that they were born into, to die to those things and to be born into his principality, to adopt his habits and forms of life. Come, take a walk with me and learn from me the unforced rhythms of grace. And that Jesus was not primarily seen as a private inner teacher of individualistic mysticism can be shown by the way that the earliest Christians, in fact, the earliest thing that any Christian ever wrote about Jesus, portrays him as an overtly political, public, and powerful figure who uses his power in a way that is responsible for the others around him. And then this passage explicitly expects that his followers will do and act likewise. It's a central pillar in the renewing of the Christian political imagination, and we're going to look at it in the following episode.